Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and your moderator for the program. And now I'm pleased to introduce our distinguished speaker, Hedrick Spith, PBS correspondent, producer, and one of the most remarkable journalists and most passionate journalists of really, for many years. He probably won't like me to say it, but he's actually been a journalist for seven decades. He started in 1959 in the South. I think it was UPI. He spent 26 years at the New York Times. He was a 1974 Pulitzer Prize winner for coverage of Russia and Eastern Europe. He's won an Emmy. He's a remarkable man who's still going quite strong, and he's made the transition from print journalist to television celebrity. He's done many front lines. You know his work from Washington Week and Review. And he's written, I think, five books. And this book is completely timely, and I'm sure we're going to have an interesting evening. So please welcome Hedrick Spith.
Thank you very much, Bob. I should tell you all that Bob and I met at the New York Times when he was a young editorial assistant, and Neil Sheehan and I were finishing the Pentagon Papers, and it was just about to be published. So we go back a long ways and have good memories of working together. Let me say also how pleased I am to be back at the Commonwealth Club and to be in San Francisco. I feel very much at home here. I've done a lot of reporting in and around San Francisco, and I've had the fun of being with you on several occasions when I've published previous books or done front lines and so forth. Thinking about where we are today in America, and I'm reminded of that Charlie Brown cartoon where Lucy has set up a card table in the backyard, and it says, "Psychiatry, 1 cent." Charlie wanders up, you know, a little adrift, a little askew, and he puts down his penny and asks Lucy to give him some analysis. She said, "Well, Charlie, before I do that, I need to have you think of life as a great voyage on an ocean liner. Are you part of that group of people that takes your deck chair to the bow and looks into the future and where you're headed? Or are you part of that group that takes your deck chair to the stern and looks back and sees where you've come from?" And Charlie pauses for a moment and he said, "Lucy, I'm having trouble getting my chair unfolded." That's a nice way of looking at America today, right? Nice way of looking at America today. I could quote a couple of people from the beginning of my book, Who Stole the American Dream, who put it a little bit more seriously. This is a quote from that famous jurist before he went on the court, Louis Brandeis, who wrote, "We must make our choice. We may have democracy, or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both." And then John W. Gardner, the longtime head of Common Cause, the public advocacy group, and cabinet secretary under President Lyndon Johnson, who wrote, "We're treading the edge of a precipice here. Civilizations die of disenchantment. If enough people doubt their society, the whole venture falls apart. We must never let anger, fashionable cynicism, or political partisanship blur our vision on that point. We must not despair of the republic." So here we are in the middle of a presidential and congressional election, and we've got more questions than we have answers. Same way I have been as a reporter and as I was working on this book. We want to elect somebody to help dig us out of the ditch, and yet we don't trust politicians, and we're not actually sure how we got where we are. We don't really know how we became two Americas, divided by money and power and ideology. How we moved from an era of middle-class prosperity and middle-class power and effective bipartisan politics in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s to today's America, where we have polarized politics, a starkly unequal democracy dominated by super PACs, even more gaping inequalities in the economy, and a middle class stuck in a rut. How did that happen? Supposedly it was globalization and new technologies, but if that's the case, then how did Germany manage to protect its middle class? How did the Germans raise the incomes of their average workers over the last 25 years five times faster than we in America have? How did the Germans manage to pile up $2 trillion of trade surpluses against the competition of China, India, and the Asian tigers, while we had $6 trillion of trade deficits in the last decade? If they were paying more, we're told our companies can't operate if they were paying their workers more. And yet Daimler-Benz, Mercedes, Siemens, BMW, all those great German companies, they were managing to do it. And then we're also told that in this new era, we've got to move to a service economy. And yet the Germans have maintained 21% of their workforce in manufacturing, and we have only 9% of our workforce in manufacturing. How do they do that if globalization affects everybody and technology affects everybody? There's something here that needs to be explored a bit further. And then, of course, in our politics, what happened to the political middle? What happened to that bipartisanship? Well, that's kind of where I began my work on this book, with those kinds of questions. And I will tell you, Robert feels good about this, this is very much a reporter's book. I didn't start with any thesis. As a matter of fact, I need to confess to you, the book that's on the table here tonight is not the book I set out to write. I signed a contract with Random House to write a book called The Dream at Risk. I was talking about the middle class being in trouble. We all knew that. Trouble with their jobs, trouble with their homes, trouble saving enough for retirement, trouble raising enough money to send their kids to a good education. And then I got into the reporting, and I got one surprise after another. I kept discovering things that I thought I knew, and it was particularly embarrassing to me because this was a period when I was covering things. I went back into the 70s and the 80s, and when I was the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times back in the late 70s under Jimmy Carter, I saw a whole bunch of blips happen. But I have to admit to you, I didn't get the trends. I learned a lot in this book. This book evolved. This book changed underneath me. And, of course, some of that is inevitable. Reporters know that there are holes in our reporting, but we don't have time to go back and plug them. We know we're doing history in salami slices, and you need to be able to put it together and get the whole salami together if you're going to really understand what's going on. And what I've tried to do here and what I really found the greatest revelation of myself was not so much individual surprises, but putting the pieces together. I don't know how many of you have read books about Lincoln, but I've read several. And I never forget the experience of reading Doris Kearns' Team of Rivals. What a genius book. And how much enlightenment she shed by giving us a new perspective on Lincoln, by carrying through not only Lincoln, but his rivals in the 1830s, the 1840s, the 1850s, and the 1860s. So by the time you got to the 1860s and you saw Lincoln interacting with the members of his cabinet and struggling with them, you had a whole new perspective on what it was like. You were there with him, with them in their era. I don't want to claim I've done something as talented and as great as that, but I will tell you that for me, I'm going to tell you about some individual surprises, but the great surprise to me here was weaving together the tapestry, putting together the whole picture. And when I did, I changed the title of my book to Who Stole the American Dream, because I concluded in the end, it wasn't what had happened to the middle class, it is what had been done to the middle class. This didn't happen by accident. And I'm not suggesting here for a moment that there were half a dozen guys sitting in a dark room somewhere deciding in a cabal, this is what we're going to do to the middle class. No, this were a bunch of people, and different people at different times and in different walks of life and in different sectors of our economy and different parts of our political system, who were simply pursuing their own goals, their own power, their own enrichment. And the middle class, in lots of cases, was the victim and the loser in these cases. So that's what I'm going to try to unfold to you rather briefly tonight and maybe more extensively in the book. Some of the surprises, I discovered, of course, that the 401k system, which we rely on now, started completely by accident. It was never intended to be what it is today. I discovered that in the housing crisis, the average American homeowners lost $6 trillion before the boom went bust. Enormous amounts of money. I discovered that most of the liar's loans were actually written by the bankers and the brokers and not by the people who were borrowing. I discovered that the main victims of the subprime loans were actually prime borrowers who were entitled to prime loans, and they'd been talked or duped or cajoled or cheated into taking loans that were really worked against them. But one of the biggest surprises to me was a story about Lewis Powell. I just want to ask in this room how many people remember the name Lewis Powell. Yeah, good number. All right, so we think of Lewis Powell, I think, as a Supreme Court justice named to the court by Richard Nixon, Republican president, at the end of 1971, who served 16 or 17 years. And interesting enough, Linda Greenhouse, New York Times Supreme Court reporter, said he had such a modest style on the court, walked around sometimes in old shoes and in his shirt sleeves, and when people would go in the court building, they would mistake Powell for one of the custodians of the building. Well, Powell was not a custodian. Powell was a very vigorous guy. It turns out that Powell, who had been a major corporate attorney and president of the American Bar Association, was not only a great believer in the American free enterprise system, but by August of 1971, Lewis Powell was convinced that the American free enterprise system was under dangerous assault and was in peril of being extinguished. It was being fought by Ralph Nader and the consumer movement, by the AFL and the trade union movement, by the environmentalists who'd pushed through a lot of environmental legislation, and by lots of regulatory legislation and action by the administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, OSHA, in the field of occupational safety and health, mine safety, traffic safety, and so forth. The irony is that most of that new regulatory regime was imposed and enacted by the very man who put Powell on the Supreme Court, Richard Nixon, a Republican president. Powell was more upset, actually, by the policies of a Republican president than by Democrat Lyndon Johnson, who preceded him. So Powell proceeded to sit down in August of 1971, and he wrote what is now known as the Powell Memorandum. And what he did was he issued a call to arms. This was a Paul Revere to business America, to corporate America. It was a corporate American manifesto. Gather yourselves. Organize. Get involved politically. Go fight aggressively in the political arena in Washington. Make a long-term game plan. Amass the money that's available in corporate America. Go after your enemies. Punish your enemies. Take over the high ground politically. And believe it or not, that is what happened. Within a couple of months, 2 or 3 months after this Powell Memorandum was circulated by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable was formed. Now, it's so much a part of the political landscape today, it's the major voice of corporate America, the 150, 160 largest corporations in America, and with enormous political clout in Washington. It's so much a fixture that you can't believe that in 1971 it didn't exist. But it got formed. The people who led those corporations took Lewis Powell very seriously, and they formed this group. The National Association of Manufacturers said, my God, we better move our headquarters to Washington. The National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is the arm of small business across America, said, we better build up our membership. And in one decade, they went from 4,000 members to 600,000 members in the NFIB. The number of companies that had offices in Washington to lobby Congress went from 175 in 1971 to 2,225 in 1981. There were probably 50,000 people by 1980 working for business trade associations. There were 9,000 registered business lobbyists and another 8,000 or 9,000 PR people. The number of corporate lobbyists outnumbered the members of Congress 130 to 1 by 1980. So 1980 we think of as the watershed period. Ronald Reagan comes to power, the Republicans get control of the Senate, and we're off to the races. Wrong. The watershed Congress, in my estimation, after going back and doing this research, was in 1978. It was a Democratic Congress, both houses controlled by the Democrats, with a Democrat sitting in the White House, Jimmy Carter. That is when things really changed, and we have been living with the change ever since. That is when the power shift that has affected American politics for the last three decades and which dominates the political landscape today, that is when it took shape and when it showed its head. How do we know? Labor expected with a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president that they would pass all kinds of legislation that would be favorable to labor and to organization of labor and to common site picketing at construction projects. Both of those key pieces of legislation for labor got bottled up in Congress, one in the House, the other in the Senate. Ralph Nader was hoping that he would be able to persuade now with Gerry Ford and Richard Nixon, the Republican presidents, out of the way, he would be able to persuade the Congress and get the Congress to pass and set up a consumer protection agency. And as you know, it took all the way to Barack Obama to get that. That was also defeated in the House. Business was able to get the 401k program started. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. It got the bankruptcy laws changed in ways that put corporate managers more in control of the bankruptcy process. It got legislation passed to lift the lid on interest rates, which had been imposed by state usury laws. And it totally rolled Jimmy Carter on taxes. You may remember Carter campaigned in 1976 on reforming the tax code. He said we had a tax code that was a disgrace to the human race. Remember that slogan? Well, what he meant to do was to close the loopholes of the wealthy and to increase the taxes on corporations and to drop a number of the lower income people off the income rolls. The tax bill that came back from Congress was exactly the opposite. The corporate tax rate was dropped a couple of percent. The capital gains rate was dropped on individuals from 48% to 28%, a very significant drop. Lower income people were not dropped off the tax rolls. The bill was going in exactly the opposite direction. And even Richard Nixon had a tax bill that had gone the other way. So this is the first tax bill in about 30 or 40 years that moved in the direction of loosening things for the wealthy and tightening up with people at the lower end of the income scale. This was a game changer, this Congress of 1978. I remember talking to Arthur Levitt, who was then the president or chairman of the American Stock Exchange, a friend of mine. He and I both went to Williams College. And Arthur said to me, you know, in this Congress, business realized that we could get what we wanted. And from now on, we're going to get more because we want more. Business had tasted power, and they wanted more power, and they wanted more of what power would deliver them in Washington. Now, in my opinion, and from my research, I believe that 1978 Congress was a game changer. Think about sports for a moment. Imagine a tennis match, Federer, Nadal, whoever you want to imagine. Imagine a football game, San Francisco Giants, whoever you want, Denver Broncos. And there's a close battle. It goes into the fourth quarter. And then there's a play. There's a rally. There's a service break. There's something that happens, and you can just sense the tide having changed. And it shifts to the other side. And you know for sure Federer's going to lose, Nadal's going to win. Hate to say it, the Giants are going to lose, the Broncos are going to win, whatever it is. Well, I had to say that to you all here, right? My point is there is a psychology in politics as well as there is in sports and in drama and many other walks of life. And this psychology changed. Of course, when Reagan came in, much more was done. Much more was changed in the tax system. There were tax cuts that delivered $1 trillion over a decade to the top 1 or 2 or 3% in America every decade. So for 3 decades since, that's $3 trillion of wealth going to the top end. And the George W. Bush tax cut added another trillion. But it was the exercise of power. It was the power shift that occurred in the Carter years, in this Congress in 1978 that marked the change. And we've been living with it ever since. Now, that is one of the most fundamental parts of the story that explains the stealing of the American dream. It is a political shift that went on. And one of the things we don't really reflect on these days, let me borrow a bit of that water. Excuse me. One of the things that we don't reflect on these days is how radically different that picture is than from what went before. We're now so used to this kind of terrain, so used to this political landscape, that we take it as natural. But before that, we had a period of middle-class power. I mentioned some of it, the environmental movement. 20 million Americans went out on the streets in April 1970, and there followed a flood of legislation from Congress. And Richard Nixon, who was no tree-hugging environmentalist, created the Environmental Protection Agency and signed a whole slew of those laws. Ralph Nader wrote Unsafe at Any Speed, talking about how General Motors and the American automakers were making cars with defects that caused all kinds of accidents, and that gave fire to the consumer movement. And you got all kinds of legislation with better product safety regulations, with more truth in labeling. In fact, you go into a grocery store or a pharmacy or lots of stores today, and you can tell the ingredients of products largely as a result of the work of that consumer movement. And then the civil rights movement. What could be more middle class, more American than the students saying, we want to drink at those water fountains, or the guys on the Freedom Rider buses saying, we want to ride in those buses, or Martin Luther King down in Birmingham, Alabama, all things that I covered at one point, saying we want our people to be able to eat in those restaurants, to stay in those hotels, to ride those buses, and to have the same shot at jobs as whites do in Birmingham, Alabama. And then he came to Washington with them. And we'll all remember, I have a dream, but there's a wonderful line that I remember. He said, we have come to cash a promissory note from American democracy that all men, yes, black men as well as white men and women, are endowed with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I was there that day. I will never forget it. That was a period of middle-class power. And one of the things that we've forgotten is that middle-class power and middle-class prosperity go together. They don't happen independently. Labor power was enormously important to establishing a good standard of living. Steady jobs, rising incomes, health benefits, retirement, embodied in a document called the Treaty of Detroit, which was the labor agreement between the United Auto Workers and General Motors in 1948, and copied all through industry, copied by Ford and Chrysler and United Steel and all through all kinds of industries. And by the way, it affected many more non-union workers than union workers, because that became the embodiment of the American dream: a steady job, rising income, health benefits, a retirement monthly paycheck from your employer as long as you lived, put that on top of Social Security, and you had a pretty good retirement, pretty secure retirement, and the hope of a better life for your kids. That was it. Economists call that period the Great Convergence. And what they mean is the distance between the incomes at the top and the middle, and between the middle and the bottom, were much more compressed than they had been in the Roaring 20s, or in the 1890s, or certainly than today. It was a great period of prosperity. And one of the reasons why it was such effective prosperity is that the middle-class workers, and by that I don't just mean assembly workers. I mean people who worked in pharmacies, grocers, plumbers, electricians, automobile repairmen, all kinds of people. They shared in the nation's gains almost equally, but they shared well in the nation's gains. If you look at the history, from 1945 to the mid-70s, the productivity of the American workforce was enormous. It virtually doubled. It rose 96.8%, almost 97%. Now, what is striking is that during that same period, the workers' average pay in America rose 95%, almost identical, a doubling of pay, a doubling of productivity. What that meant was that the working class, the middle class, throughout America was sharing in the nation's gains. The growth rate was good, the productivity was going up, corporate profits were going up, and the workers were getting their share. And I say, workers across the board. From 1973, and this is the watershed period, and it's interesting because it's close to coinciding with the political power shift in Washington, okay? From 1973 to 2011, which is the last year for which we have figures, the productivity of the American workforce rose 80%, almost as much as before, not quite, but a very impressive achievement. The average hourly compensation, which is wages plus benefits, rose 10%. 80% rise in productivity, 10% rise in pay. That's what I call wedge economics. There's a wedge being driven between the returns to the nation, the returns to corporate profits, the returns to corporate leadership, and the returns to rank-and-file workers. Wedge economics. In fact, the Census Bureau put out figures last year that said the average hourly wage of a male worker was the same in 2011 as in 1978, adjusted for inflation. In fact, just a little bit less. So that's three decades of getting nowhere. And at the same time, the pay of a CEO at a large company went from 40 times the pay of an average worker to 360 times the pay of an average worker, an enormous change. The incomes of the top 1% in America multiplied sixfold at the same time the middle class was at this static, flat level. So that's what wedge economics are about. That's where the dream got stolen. And there were other things that happened along with it, but that's really the most striking thing for us to remember. Now, we're told, of course, what had gone on before was that we had this virtuous circle of economic growth, the kind of thing that Henry Ford started with, a $5 day. Pay your workers well, and they can afford to buy the Model T. That really is what happened in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Pay workers well, it generates huge consumer demand. They go out and spend their money. If they go out and spend their money, then business has to expand production, build new plants, buy new equipment, hire more workers, and you get another round of growth. Now, I don't want to say that from 1945 to 75 there weren't any business cycles. Of course there were. But if you look at the trend, the same way you look at the trend in the stock market, it goes up and down, but you can see the trend going up steadily. You know, that's just not what happened. We've dismantled that very powerful driver of American economic growth. In fact, we have a debate today about the job creators. Can't afford to raise the taxes at the upper end because we'll kill the job creators. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to get back to sensible economics. The job creators in America are the middle class consumers. We have business now sitting on roughly $2 trillion of capital, and it has been for the last two or three or four years. The problem isn't a shortage of capital. The problem is a shortage of consumer demand. That's where the problem is. Low pay means low demand, means low growth, means long jobless recoveries. Now, the answer we get back is you can't afford to pay more. We can't afford to pay our workers more, or it'll put us out of business. We can't compete, it'll put us out of business. But then you have to go to Germany. If that's true, how can Germany have raised its workers' pay on average five times as fast as we have? And if they did, how can they have a trade surplus of $2 trillion while we have $6 trillion deficit? And if we can't make it through manufacturing, then how come they've got 21% of their workers in manufacturing and we have only 9%? The answer is, it's the way the income gets divvied up. I don't know if you noticed the news not long ago. Caterpillar had a strike. Caterpillar in 2011, the manufacturer of all that great farm equipment that we export abroad and use in this country, had a record profit of $4.9 billion in 2011. They had a strike, and they fought the strike, and they imposed a wage freeze on their workers. And the union was so weak that they, in the end, they wound up by accepting it. Now, where is that $4.9 billion going to go? It's not going to evaporate. It is either going to go to large stock options for the CEO and the executives, or it's going to go to large Wall Street investors and some middle-class investors who've got mutual funds and IRAs, or it's going to go back to buy back stock. American companies spent $550 billion last year, uncertain about how to grow, but they bought back stock. Why? Because that jacks up the stock price, and if you jack up the stock price, the executives all get paid more because they get paid in stock. So that money is going somewhere. And if it's not going to the middle class, not only is the middle class losing, our economy is losing. The same thing could be said about the housing area. All kinds of problems in housing. The way we worked the mortgage in the 2000s and the 1990s was upside down. We had what I call the upside down mortgage. You know, the old idea of the mortgage was you got out of college, you met a girl, she met a guy, you got married, you had some kids, you got in your early 30s, and you decided to buy a house. And so for 30 years, you plunked down monthly your payment on the mortgage. And when you hit 65, you had a house paid for. That was the whole idea. And the banks encouraged you to do that. They thought it was a great idea. Own your own home. Be secure in retirement. It all got turned upside down. And what happened in the 1990s and 2000s where banks were saying, go ahead, take some money out. Borrow. Go take a vacation. Oh, you got medical expenses? Oh, you want to add to your house? You can't keep up with your payments? Take money out of your house. House prices are going up. What happened was that year after year in the 2000s, American homeowners took out $750 billion a year from home equity. And the ownership owned by the homeowners went from 70% of the total value of housing in America back in the late 1980s to 40% in 2000. It's a $20 trillion market. If you lose 30% of your ownership, that's $6 trillion. That $6 trillion went from homeowners to banks to investors. Mammoth loss, mammoth transfer. People talk about trickle-down economics. This is geyser-up economics in an enormous scale. This happened in one field after another. We can look at retirement. The 401k system is another way in which the burden of paying for retirement got shifted from companies to the middle class. So the middle class has been really burdened and stuck. Question, what do we do about it? Is there anything we can do about it, or is it too far? Is it gone? Well, I have to tell you, I had quite an argument with my editor about this because she said, you can't take people to the point where I've taken you tonight and leave people sitting there out there at the end of the limb feeling terrible about the way things have gone without saying anything about what you can do. And I said to her, look, I'm a reporter. I'm a journalist. Journalists don't do policy things. I'm not a policy wonk. My job is to analyze the story and to tell people if we'll never get a smart fix in this country unless we figure out what the problems are. And this is how I see the problem. She said, no, you can't do that. And I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And my wife said, listen to your editor. So I did it. You have to know, my wife is my first editor, Susan Zock. She's a wonderful person, and she's a wonderful editor. She said, you got to do it. So there's a Hedrick Smith 10-point plan, how to fix America. I'm glad you laughed, because I laughed, too, at the thought of it. But actually, some of the ideas are really very simple, and it doesn't take a genius to figure things out. We have a tax system today in which we have corporations that do their business mainly in America. They get taxed at 35%, which is the official tax rate. They create jobs in America. They maintain jobs in America. I'm talking about Costco. I'm talking about insurance companies, trucking companies, restaurants. Everybody's got to do business here, small business owners, all that kind of stuff. But if you ship your jobs overseas in your General Electric or your IBM or your General Motors and you get lots of profits overseas, you don't have to pay taxes on those profits overseas unless you bring them back. And so you decide to build more plants overseas. So you never have to pay taxes on that. So, you know, from 2006 to 2008, General Electric made $10.5 billion in profits. How much did they pay in taxes? They paid what George Romney says all this 47% paid. Zero. They paid no taxes. Not only that, they got a $4.5 billion rebate from the federal government because they had so many tax credits and so many write-offs. That's crazy. How can we have a system like that? Okay? So that's one thing we could talk about. Another thing we could talk about is the banks. The banks got bailed out to the tune of $700 billion. Okay? We paid it. They're making profits. The bonuses are back. Why can't we say to the banks, look, there are 20 million Americans who are in underwater homes. That is, their homes are worth less than their mortgages. And they're stuck with bubble-era interest rates of like 8 or 9%. And they are religiously, these are people paying their mortgages month in and month out on a financially losing proposition. Why can't we say to the banks, look, you got to bail out, now you bail out these people, you refinance their homes. Banks are saying, no, we'll lose profits. Wait a second, we guaranteed your profits when you were losing. So let's get back to some kind of fairness here. So those are some of Smith's points. There are more. But the most important one is to go back to this idea that middle-class prosperity and middle-class power go together. I got some ideas about restoring the political middle as well. But this is the most important thing. This is a testing time for American democracy. I do not believe, I think it matters who gets elected, and I'm not going to get into the election. My book is not about the election. It's about the issues that lie underneath the election. But no matter who gets elected, they're going to have to deal with the problems that I've set out in this book. And in my opinion, no matter who gets elected, and even if one party gets everything, Democrats get House, Senate, and White House, or Republicans get House, Senate, or White House, they're not going to solve these problems unless the middle class gets engaged and starts demanding a middle class agenda the way the middle class did in the 1960s and the 1970s. Ladies and gentlemen, I firmly believe, And this is a reporter going way out of limb. I can say I believe this passionately. And I have all kinds of colleagues that say, Rick, you're totally unrealistic. And my answer to them is, you're totally unrealistic if you think Washington is going to do it on its own. It is not going to do it on its own. Lobbyists are way too powerful. It's a lopsided playing field. It's not going to happen. The only way it's going to happen, ladies and gentlemen, in my estimation, is if middle-class people get involved and demonstrate, and they put a firm hand right here in the middle of the back of Washington and say, move, and move in our direction. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Hedrick Smith, PBS correspondent and producer, former Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter and author of the new book, Who Stole the American Dream? And I'll tell you a little secret. He's been up since 4 o'clock this morning, and until about 5 minutes before he walked in here, he didn't know he had to say anything besides have a conversation. So imagine if he was prepared. But now it's time for our audience questions period, and we have a number of questions. You've been on your book tour today. Are you aware of, I know you don't, this book is not about the campaign, but in terms of the timeliness, are you aware of the video that was released at Mitt Romney with the 47%?
I think I am.
So I don't. There's a bunch of questions here from the audience and sort of your reaction to that, and if you can extrapolate, if possible, some of the numbers you think he may be using and what really that means.
Yeah, I have to say that I've rather deliberately not gotten into partisan comments about this campaign. I think the issues in front of us, I'll answer your question in a moment, but I think the issues in front of the country are so vital and so important, and I am so frustrated by the superficiality of the campaign. I don't believe that either candidate, either party, is really digging into the tough issues, and there's a good reason for it. It's traditional in American politics that people run for president, they pick a few things they want to run on, and they avoid everything else because anything else they say might alienate some voters, and there's always that thing that could tip Colorado or tip Nevada or tip Illinois or tip Ohio or tip Florida, and so they walk on eggs. And by the way, I think the media is doing the same thing. I mean, we are not really learning much from this campaign about what the predicament of America is, and we're not getting those problems addressed. So I regard an awful lot of this stuff as trivia, but some of these remarks are revealing. I guess my question for Mr. Romney would be, if these are freeloaders, and let's admit, if we're talking about 47% of the public not paying taxes, I'm not sure whether that number is exactly right, but let's assume it's essentially correct. Probably 20-25% of them live below poverty. And you have to understand, a lot of those people who live below poverty are working. They're working. They're making $15,000 a year. Do you know 20% of the American population is living on household income of under $21,000. Household income of under $21,000. Now, for people in this room, including myself, it is very hard to picture how anybody can do that. And I don't care whether it's Obama or Romney or whoever it is, but people who've lived as fortunate lives as both of those candidates and most of the people in Congress, by the way, almost half the people in Congress are millionaires. You should know that. That's in my book. You should also know that more than half of the Tea Party members elected to the House in 2010 are millionaires, and their average net worth is $1.8 million. So I don't regard many of these politicians as being very populistic and very sensitive to the needs of people at the lower end of the income scale. So that it's not just about Romney. I think it's a general unawareness. But I also think that this notion of taking a look at who pays zero income taxes, then let's take a look at the big corporations that pay zero income taxes. And there's a hit list of blue chip companies that are paying zero income taxes. And the day any candidate, I won't name one, but the day any candidate gets up and wants to blast individuals for not paying taxes, I want to see the consistency of his saying the same thing about corporations that aren't paying taxes. Then we can at least address the issue of who should be paying taxes and who isn't paying taxes. And I don't mean that in a partisan way. I mean, we are talking nonsense in a lot of our politics today, and we've got to get to the straight facts, the straight truth. And, you know, I have to tell you, I think reporters are partly to blame. I don't think we're pushing people very hard on these things. We're doing this. What do you think, Governor Romney? Well, now, what do you say, President Obama? Or what do you say, campaign spokesman? Or what do you say, White House spokesman? And we get this one saying, this is blather. And we get saying this one saying, this is anti-blather. Okay, we've done our job. No, I'm sorry. It's not blather and anti-blather. You can have your opinions. You can have your policies. But you can't play with the facts. You can't tell the American people today, factually, you can advocate lower taxes, but you cannot tell people factually that lowering taxes increases growth. Under Dwight Eisenhower, the maximum tax rate was, listen to it, 92%. The maximum tax rate under John Kennedy was 77%. The maximum tax rate under George W. Bush was 35%. The growth rate under Eisenhower and Kennedy runs circles around George W. Bush's growth rate. It was the worst record in 70 years. Now, you can say we should lower the taxes and make an argument for it, but you can't claim the historical record shows that that actually generates growth. And there are lots of other numbers I could throw at you that make the same point. So I would say, in terms of this episode, let's try to get away from the bubble inflated rhetoric of the campaign, and let's get back down to facts.
One really specific question several people have asked is, I'm paraphrasing, should taxes on the rich be raised, if you want to address that, and the impact of Glass-Steagall being, should that be read?
Yeah, I think in the first place, you have to recognize that among all the lobbies in Washington, the financial lobby, the lobby representing the Wall Street banks and the financial industry, is the single most powerful lobby. It gets most of its way most of the time. It does it both by lobbying, and by the way, during the financial regulatory, I'll get to the specific Glass-Steagall in a moment, and during the financial regulatory debate over passing the new legislation, the Wall Street banks and the financial industry hired 1,447 former members of Congress, former staff people in Congress, and former government officials either to defeat the legislation or to water it down and pull its teeth so it couldn't have effect on the banks. And, ladies and gentlemen, they succeeded. We do not have the protections today, regardless of what the president says. We do not have the protections financially against another financial collapse. And one reason is the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 said that banks involved in taking your deposits, involved in commercial banking, could not engage in investment gambling. Investment banking and commercial banking were separate. There was a line between them. The fact is, if you go back to 1980, in the early 1980s, Alan Greenspan, as chairman of the Federal Reserve, began to water that down. There is some loose language in Glass-Steagall, and he used that to say, well, it says they cannot be principally engaged in investment banking if they're in commercial banking. He said, well, principally, they can do 5%. Nobody paid much attention. Greenspan raised that to 10%. Nobody paid much attention. Greenspan raised that to 25%. And then the lobbyists went to work under Clinton, under the Democrats. Let's be straight about this. This was not strictly a Republican push. The Democrats were right in the thick of it. Robert Rubin was the Secretary of the Treasury, former top official at Goldman Sachs, and they went and they lobbied Congress and they got Glass-Steagall repealed. One of the interesting things I discovered is that there is a symbiosis between Washington and Wall Street. There is so much transfer back and forth, so much revolving door, that sometimes it's very hard to tell who is where. Of course, Robert Rubin was the Treasury Secretary to Clinton, and Henry Paulson, another top Goldman executive, was the Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush. What's not so well known, you get Wall Street officials working for Republican administration. All three chiefs of staff who work for Barack Obama, Rahm Emanuel made $18 million on Wall Street before he went to work for Barack Obama. William Daley was the former vice chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase working on Wall Street. And Jack Lew, the current chief of staff, also worked for Wall Street. So it is not just a matter of lobbying. There's an infiltration of philosophy that affects the way our government operates. That's the stuff that's really tough to root out. It's in both parties. And it's deeply embedded. And it goes back to Lewis Powell, his memorandum, and that revolt on the part of business leaders.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is veteran journalist and author Hedrick Smith, who is discussing the future of the American dream. A lot of the questions are dealing sort of with civility, and you're talking about the symbiotic relationship between Wall Street, the financial sector, and government. And then you have this, you know, basically two parties at each other's throats. How do you see a solution? You mentioned the middle class getting involved, but how do you break this? Does there have to be some cataclysmic event to change things?
Well, we had a cataclysmic event. It was called the collapse of 2008, and it didn't change things. So maybe we have to have another one. I'd be sad to say that. Let's go to civility. All of us would like to have whatever disagreement we have expressed civilly, be able to have discourse. I watched, over my 50 years as a reporter, I watched that civility breakdown, but I watched something much more important breakdown. And that is the overlap between the parties in Congress. There are political scientists who have literally graphed the votes and the voting patterns in Congress, almost like Rorschach tests that you can see, ink blots on paper. And if you go back to the 1970s, 1960s, and move forward, you can see the overlap of the Democratic votes and the Republican votes in the House and the Senate. But as you move forward, these ink blots start to move apart. And now there's literally a white space, a no man's land. There isn't any overlap anymore. Now, this starts really happening with the Civil Rights Act of 1965, because the South was deeply offended by that. A lot of Southern whites began initially voting for conservative Democrats and switched to the Republican Party. And over time, the South has become the most reliable political base of the Republican Party in terms of members of the Senate, members of the House, and in terms of backing presidential candidates. And at the same time, the Northeast and the Middle West were becoming more and more Democratic. And it really a terrible thing happened. We used to have wonderful Republican moderate senators like Jacob Javits of New York and Clifford Case of New Jersey and Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania, and Margaret Chase Smith of Maine and so on and so forth. Now, Maine still happens to be a place, excuse me, that generates moderate Republicans. But that's a dying breed. And we really have to find ways to reopen the political middle, and that will do more to create meaningful civility, not just politeness, but generally talking to each other and trying to bridge the gap between the parties than just talking more nicely. I think there are a couple of ways we can do that. One is we should take the business of reallocating the congressional districts out of the hands of legislatures and governors and turn it over to the courts. That has been done in a few cases. It's actually been done in California in legislative districts, and what has followed in the years after that are much more even elections and much better, much more contested elections. The second thing we could do would be to have single primaries where everybody from both parties runs in the same primary. Now, why do you want to do that? A lot of people say you're going to undermine the parties. And there are other people who say maybe that's a good idea at this point. And actually, George Washington issued a warning against the pernicious effect of political parties in his famous farewell address. So it's not a new idea. It was an idea that worried him. The idea here is that at the moment in the political primaries, Republican or Democratic, it's the party loyalists. It's the most energetic and usually the most extreme voters in each party that vote. So they tend to pull the parties towards extremes. But if you put everybody in the same pool, you say the top two vote-getters, hopefully one's a Democrat and one's a Republican, but the top two vote-getters get to run in the general election. You put much more pressure on people to appeal to the middle because you don't know who's going to vote there, and you're appealing to both parties. And actually, it's begun in Washington State. Washington State has single primaries in its congressional districts, and it's in gubernatorial races. It's only done this once or twice, but already we see turnout going up, and we see more moderation in the tone of the political campaigns. So those are a couple of things that we could actually do.
A good deal of the book talks about the global economy, and one thing we haven't touched on yet, and it influences a lot of things, is imperial outreach. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that means to us?
Imperial outreach or imperial overstretch?
Overstretch.
Okay. What I'm talking about imperial overstretch here is the amount of money we're spending on the military and something else. And here we are in the middle of this crisis in the Middle East. And if you listen to the debate that's going on now, the implication is that we could actually control things out there. If we just told those people to stop, they'd stop. Well, I'm sorry. That's an imperial notion. And the laughter in this crowd suggests that you understand that. One of the interesting things about history is that almost every great power, you can go back to China, but more recently, Holland, Spain, Britain, if you go back to the history of those empires, they grew to be powerful nations and to be able to project their power abroad because of the strength of their economies. Every single one of them, and we're now next, has overreached. It's called imperial overstretch. As the economy is actually peaking out in its ability to generate more growth at the same rate that it used to, as it is facing other competitors economically, that's the time the generals, the admirals, and some of the politicians say, we need to go to X, Y, Z, you name it, Iraq, Afghanistan, and who knows where now. And that's the problem we're having. If you knew this, we have something like 1,000 bases around the world. We pride ourselves in not being a colonial nation, meaning we haven't taken colonies. Well, we did for a while in the Philippines, and, you know, we still got Puerto Rico, but that doesn't really, we don't count that. But the real thing that we've done, and we've been very shrewd about this, is to put bases all around the world. We don't need to control the governments over there. The bases do it for us. But the question is, can we afford it? And, you know, it's interesting, when the drawdown began in Afghanistan last year, there were people saying, mayors in American cities saying, why don't we draw down faster? Why are we building bridges in Kandahar instead of in Kansas City? So that's what imperial overstretch is about. Let me just leave you with one set of facts. Two sets of facts. The wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the cost that will flow from them, particularly in the benefits and the health care that we have to provide to the thousands of people who have been wounded over there and who have mental problems and all kinds of things. The cost of those wars is at a minimum $3.5 trillion. Now, if you had that $3.5 trillion back, think what you could do to the national deficit, right? Or the debt. Tremendous change. It could go as high as $4 trillion, $4.5 trillion. I've seen several estimates. I quote them in the book. But what you also need to know is that today, American military spending, the baseline spending of the Pentagon as well as the wars, is $200 billion a year higher than it was at the peak of the Cold War when we faced a nuclear-armed enemy challenging us around the world. Now, I would submit it'd be smarter to take that $200 billion and rebuild the roads, the ports, the highways, the airports, of this country. And indeed, I got to tell you, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO agree on that. They advocate that. There are CEOs of companies like Andy Grove at Intel and the guy who runs Dow Chemical, whose name I forget at the moment, and a whole bunch of other CEOs who've said this. This is not just labor. This is not just liberals. These are people who are saying the Chamber of Commerce says we are losing $1 trillion in the global market because our infrastructure is so outdated. It takes as long to move a train through the city of Chicago as it does to move it from Los Angeles to Chicago because of the bottlenecks. The amount of time people spend on bad roads in their cars is an enormous wage and cost to the economy. So we're not being very sensible about a lot of the policies that we're pursuing, and the area of imperial overstretch is another place that's costing the middle class. That's another area where you're not looking at it, but it's coming out of the pockets of programs that would help retrain workers, help restart companies that are having competitive problems, support research and development, do all kinds of things that would make America a much more globally competitive country than we are. And the military spending is not getting us there. It's not actually in terms of job creation. There are economists who have shown demonstrably that military spending is not as efficient as spending in the civilian sector.
This is slightly off topic, but also timely as hell. What, as you're watching what's happening with Iran, in terms of the brinksmanship and obviously the economic potential fallout from something happening there, what's your read on that?
I'm going to take a buy on that. Iran is an enormously complicated problem. There is no simple solution, and there clearly isn't any clarity on the intelligence on where the things stand. And there's a fundamental disagreement, obviously, right now between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama in terms of what we should do. But I will tell you honestly, that is not a subject I've researched. I spent the last 2.5 years trying to take a look at how the American economy and how the American political system operates. And I wouldn't want to go out on a limb there where I don't really know what I'm talking about any more than what I read in the paper.
You have your next assignment. So back to the book, which is full of incredible details and has, I think, 94 pages of footnotes, not 75. But
somebody says it's a long book. It's got a lot of it's got 1,000 footnotes in it or something like that.
But you wove in characters who were instrumental, some who were well-known readers and others are not. But can you talk a little bit about Dirk van Dongen? Because I think he represents...
Dirkus van Dongen.
A key role, and probably not many people have heard of him. And also tie that in, please, to the could happen with the tax cuts expiring at the end of this year.
Well, I want to do that, but I'd also like to talk about Pat O'Neill, the jet airline mechanic who worked 35 years on the flight line at O'Hare, repairing jets at night in cold, freezing weather, and wanted to retire at age 55 and had been promised a pension. And he'd signed a contract along with everybody else. And then when United was in trouble back in the 1990s, he and a lot of other employees bought employee stock option plans. They bought some of United Airlines stock. Just about the time he decided to retire, United filed for bankruptcy. Well, the stock that he spent $80,000 on was suddenly worth $2,000. The pension that he'd counted on for $3,000 a month got dumped on a government entity, and it was worth $1,000 less a month for the rest of his life than he'd counted on before. And his 401k plan also went kaplooey. I talked to Pat O'Neill. This is a wonderful guy. He's a real middle-class Irish-American working on the flight line, believes in America, and he said, I was just dying to go back to Indiana where I grew up and go around in the camper when I retired. But he couldn't do it. When he retired, he had to go back to work, and he drove long-haul trucks for about 6 or 7 years. And he's away from home all the time, and his kidneys are getting bad bouncing on the roads, and he can't stand being away from his wife. So finally he quits that job, and he moves to eastern Washington, away from Seattle, where he'd lived before, thinking it would be cheaper. And he gets out there, and he puts out all kinds of job resumes, and he can't get a job. And finally, he sets up his own lawn mowing company. He's a small businessman for a while. And he does it in development. And then a relative of the developer comes along and says he wants the contract, so they bump Pat O'Neill out of it. Now, Pat O'Neill, being an Irishman from Chicago, is a Democrat, and he's moved to eastern Washington, and it's a solidly Republican county. But he decides to run for county commissioner because he figures out that the guy who's the county commissioner there is a schnook and nobody likes him, and so he runs against him, and he does it the old-fashioned way, and he shakes hands with everybody, and he's a wonderfully gregarious guy, and lo and behold, he gets elected. So I'm talking to Pat O'Neill. I've known Pat O'Neill now for about 10 or 12 years. I got a bunch of characters in this book that I followed for a long period of time. I'll get back to Dirk van Dongen in a minute. But Pat O'Neill is there, and I'm talking to him, and I said, how's it going? He says, well, I got a decent salary. Pat O'Neill, of course, is now in his late 60s. And I said, so how does it look for retirement? He says, I don't know. He says, I think I'm going to have to run for another term. And then I said, and not only that, he's working part-time for the local hotels to set up, meetings. He's the guy who puts the tables out and the chairs out. This guy's the county commissioner right there, and he's doing this. And he's not angry. He's not angry at America. And he hasn't given up on the American dream, but he says, boy, they sure chipped the hell out of it as far as I'm concerned, He is angry at the management of United. And I said, so what do you think? Are you ever going to retire? He said, retirement, he says to me, it looks like, one of those mirages receding on the horizon. And he says, I don't think the bones are going to take it much longer. He says, all those nights on the flight line, he says, the legs are giving out. I don't think I'm going to make it. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a story that could be told hundreds of times. And I got Pam Scholl, who lost her job working for an RCA plant. And I've got Bree Heller, who was a real estate agent, who got, believe it or not, got jimmied into a bad home mortgage by her own bank. And I've got John Turboss, the small businessman who got talked into refinancing his home so many times that when he got done, he'd lost $150,000 just on refinancing because the fees were so heavy. By the way, a very interesting fee. There's a thing on your HUD-1 when you buy a house. There's a little thing. Look for it if you ever trade again. It's called YSP. It's called the yield spread premium. It's the bonus the banks pay to the brokers for getting you to buy a loan with an interest rate that is very much higher than what they borrow their money at. That's the yield spread. And the guy gets a premium. Now, if you look down the column where it says borrower, that cost is not listed. And if you ask your bank, am I paying that? The guy will probably say, no, you're not paying that. The broker, he'll say, you're not paying that. The bank is paying that. But what he doesn't tell you is the bank has added that cost. In the case of John Turboss, it was $19,000 on one of his loans. They added that to the interest rate to take care of it. And then they put a hooker in these bad loans, and it's called a prepayment penalty. If you discover you got a bad loan and the bank is really reaming you terribly, and you want to get out of it by paying it off, they throw a $25,000 penalty on it for your paying it early. So that's how Turboss lost on it. I mean, there's so many tricks in this game, it's terrible. Now, Dirk Van Dongen. Dirk Van Dongen is a name you have never heard of, but you should know. He is the leader of the Gang of Six. Now, most people in the Washington media think the Gang of Six is six senators who were working on trying to come up with a budget compromise. But the Gang of Six, in terms of the power shift, is Lewis Powell's army. The Gang of Six is the Business Roundtable, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the National Association of Wholesalers and Distributors, and the National Association of Restaurants. And Dirk Van Dongen is their field marshal. And when George W. Bush came to office, shortly after came to office, within the first week, one of the first guys that Karl Rove had lunch with was Dirk Van Dongen. And why? Because Dirk is the guy who helps organize the business lobbies to push through the tax cuts. And by the way, public opinion on those tax cuts was opposed to the Bush tax cuts back then. It isn't just recent. They were afraid the tax cuts were too tilted in favor of the wealthy. And also, Clinton had had budget surpluses, and a lot of people said, well, why don't we spend the money on education? Or why don't we bring down the national debt? Or why don't we put it in Social Security? Why do we have tax cuts? That's not how the Gang of Six felt. They wanted to have tax cuts, and so did the president, and that's what we got, tax cuts. And in 2003, after 3 years of George W. Bush tax cuts, in the East Room of the White House, when George W. Bush got up to sign the third tax cut bill that he did, he got up and he thanked members of Congress and leaders of the committees, and he thanked members of his cabinet, and then he said, I want to thank my friend Dirkus. That was the president's nickname for Dirk Van Dongen. So one of the characters I've got in my book is a character like that that nobody's ever heard of, who plays a very important role as a Washington power insider.
Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where there's only one last question, so I'm going to read the last paragraph of your book. We are at a defining moment for America. We cannot allow the slow, poisonous polarization and disintegration of our great democracy to continue. We must come together and take action to rejuvenate our nation and to restore fairness and hope in our way of life. We see the challenge. It is now time. We, the people, must take action. So that's really a stirring call. And if you had 2 minutes, which is about what we have, with Obama and Romney in a room, what would you say to them?
I would say that it's time to move away from rhetoric to reality. I would say it's time to face up to what actually has happened in our past and stop talking in terms of mythology. I would say that this nation not only can't afford a middle-class agenda, it absolutely has to have it. There's all kinds of evidence in economic studies, and I quote these as well. There's all kinds of evidence in economic studies that large inequalities of income, such as we have in America today, and we have it worse than any other country, major country in the world, is bad for economic growth. It actually destroys economic growth. One of the reasons why we had such high growth under Eisenhower and Kennedy, even though we had high taxes, is the Great Compression works in favor of economic growth. And it does for the reasons I cited earlier, which is its strong consumer demand. You have to, a middle class powers this country. And so what we need to do is to talk about how we get the middle class back to powering this country. And each of you should be reaching out to the middle class and encouraging people to get involved. You should be reaching out to them and saying, you know, we need your involvement. And then each of you should start going around and actually fixing some of the very observable problems we have. The infrastructure is one, the taxes are another, the imbalance in the housing situation is another. And in my list of 10, I've got 7 points, 8 points in the economy, and I've got 2 political points. I would say it's too serious. Lincoln warned us, a house divided against itself cannot stand. We are currently today in America a house divided. Divided mostly and most unhealthily by enormous concentrations of wealth, and that concentration of wealth reinforces the concentration of political power. This is a fateful time for American democracy. We can't afford cheap responses. We can't afford debates about leaving out half of the American people. We've got to engage the American people. We've got to embrace the American people. And we need once again to think of America as a family. A family in which the people who are well off help the people who aren't so well off, and the people whose fates improve turn around and help their brothers and their sisters. We need to pull together as a nation. If we don't, we're going to follow other civilizations right down the path. And actually, my book begins with Arnold Toynbee talking about the rise and fall of civilizations. And it tells it in terms of the story of challenge and response. Civilizations are challenged by enemies from outside. They're challenged by disease. They're challenged by the environment. And some of them are challenged from within. We're a society that is challenged from within. We have to meet our own challenge. We have to come together as a people. Otherwise, we're going down. Thank you.
Our thanks to Hedrick Smith, PBS correspondent and producer, former Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter, and author of the new book, Who Stole the American Dream. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet, and we want to remind everyone that copies of Mr. Smith's new book, Who Stole the American Dream, are on sale in the lobby, and he will be pleased to sign them. I'm Robert Rosenthal, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you know you're in the know, is adjourned.